What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Kachava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans. Quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Kachava's all-in-one nutrition shake and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Whether you're craving that coffee taste to kickstart your morning ritual or as a nutrient-packed reward to round out your afternoon, Kachava keeps you fueled and satisfied wherever your day takes you. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. And for the times you feel like switching it up, you've got 7 flavors to choose from, all with the highest quality ingredients. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to kachava.com and use code FITNESS. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's kachava.com, code FITNESS.
Turn your tax refund into a new landscape with Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Create stunning patios and build strong retaining walls with our huge in-stock selection of beautiful concrete blocks ready to take home today. Plus, easily build and design your own raised garden beds with our garden block. On sale now. Check out our weekly flyer and start saving on landscape blocks now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
5 a.m., I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius, live, fit, go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic. With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway, wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
This episode of the Hunting Gear Podcast is brought to you by the Moultrie Mobile Feed Hub. How many times have you gone to check your deer feeder only to realize that it wasn't working properly and your well-planned hunt would be a waste of time because there's no telling how long it had been empty or clogged? Well, the Feed Hub solves all of these problems by bringing the power and convenience of cellular technology directly to your deer feeder. With the Feed Hub, you have complete control over feed times and you can rest easy knowing your feeder is working properly and you'll be ready for your next hunt. The Feed Hub's universal design means it'll work with most major brands of feeders, and you can learn more information at MoultrieMobile.com. Today's episode of the Hunting Gear Podcast is brought to you by Code Blue Scents. Not only do they have an extensive lineup of deer scents and urines, but they also have some scent elimination products like laundry detergent, field spray, and everything else you need. So before you get started with your hunt this season, be sure to check out Code Blue Scents. Hey guys, I'm Cameron Stover from Hunting Gear Deals to bring you another episode of the Hunting Gear Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Terry Denman, the owner and CEO of Mojo Outdoors. Welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be here, Cameron.
Hey, I'm looking forward to learning more about you, your brand, and a little bit about waterfowl hunting because I've never waterfowl hunted, but I hope to this season.
Well, I've waterfowl hunted a lot, so which I can say I know everything about it, but no one will ever know everything about it. But there are certainly some basic rules that a person should learn.
All right. Well, let's just jump into it. What is Mojo and how did you get started in this industry?
Well, Mojo is an outdoor brand that makes hunting products, mostly hunting products. We have a couple of shooting products. We have that magnetic pick stick, pick holes up, a few things like that. You know, they're not necessarily hunting products, but we mostly make hunting products. And our bread and butter has been, since the beginning, the spinning wing decoy, even though we make lots of other motion type decoys. But how we got started is kind of a kind of a unique story in itself. We did not invent the spinning wing concept for ducks. A lot of people credit us for that, but it was going on in the state of California for several years before we even ever heard about it. But it finally made its way to the lower Mississippi Flyway, more Mississippi Valley, where we're at. We're in northeast Louisiana. And it was such a hit, you know, it just worked so great then. And we have a friend that owns a very large sporting goods store here, Bass Pro Size sporting goods here. And somebody came hunting with him and brought one. And once he seen it, he started telling people about it. Well, all these duck hunters, lots of duck hunters in this area, all these duck hunters wanted one. But once it got out of California, the demand exceeded supply. You couldn't buy one. And so he called one of my best friends in the world that I grew up with, who's a tinkerer type guy. He grew up on a big farm, has a degree in agribusiness, all that stuff. But what he really loved to do was invent things and tinker. And of course, we all knew that he could build anything. So the sporting good guy, who was Jeff Simmons, called this guy, whose name was Murray Crow, and asked him if he could build him some. And this was in duck season now, you know, in the middle of duck season now. So Murray told him, yeah, I'll build you some. He said, so send me one of them over here, whatever you want to do. Now, Murray's family and my family owned a farm that we duck hunted on together, but Murray hated duck hunting. He didn't go duck hunting. He's a whitetail guy. He's always going to go whitetail hunting, you know. And so the ones that came out of California had a high-speed motor, real high-speed motor, like runs an old VCR or remote control car or something like that. And to slow it down, they used a couple of the pulleys, and they had a drive belt. The drive belt was an O-ring, and you know, the thing was noisy and didn't take much to stop it. So he didn't know how to size the pulleys. And since I'm his friend, but more important because I'm in the engineering world, you know, he just called me and started telling me about this decoy and asked me, could I size these pulleys? Well, you know, when you first hear about spinning wing decoy, and you're going to turn these wings and they're dark on one side and white on the other, blah, 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 blah. It don't make any sense. It's not intuitive at all, you know. Right. It's not what you think it would scare a duck off, but it wouldn't. At that time, it would just suck them out of the air, you know. So I would never answer his question. I would just say, tell me again about this decoy. What does it do, you know? And he finally said, I don't know. Can you size the pulleys? I said, oh, yeah, that's very simple. I said, I'll come up to your shop. Your shop is about 10 or 15 miles from my engineering company. I said, I'll come up to your shop noon tomorrow. We'll take a look at it. So I go up there and we start looking at it. And first thing, we both come to the conclusion that it's not a very good way of doing this. And that's as far as I went that day. You know, I get credit oftentimes for having developed that first spinning wing Mojo product, but I really didn't. And he said, I think I know how to fix that. I said, come back tomorrow. And because of his agriculture background, I guess, plus, he built race cars, and he balanced people's race car engine. And so he was used to dealing with that kind of stuff. He had some 24-volt. The 24-volt is going to be very important in this in the end. He has some 24-volt double-shafted blower motors out of a Caterpillar cab, okay? And so he took one of those motors, this big motor, very strong, you know, compared to what they had, and in DC motors, battery motors, the speed that they turn is proportional to the bolt that you put to it. For AC, that like you plug in your house, that's the totally opposite for it. But on DC motors, they'll turn proportional to the speed, proportional to the voltage that you put on it. So he put a 6-volt lanyard battery on a 24-volt motor, and that cuts the speed down to 25%. You know, out of 24, 25%. And so that turned out to be about the right speed, as best anybody could tell back then. As it turned out to be excellent speed. It was about 700 RPM, 750 RPM. Yeah. Then he took some of that aluminum that they wrapped in race cars with and cut wings out of it. The other guy was using plastic wings, you know. And he hooked those wings directly to the motor shaft. So he don't have any pulleys, belts, drives. You know, that's a direct drive process, you know. And so it was a very, very durable overkill compared to what was out there at the time. And then he started off building these things, got all his buddies at home with shops around town that worked on race cars at night when he get off work. You know, this guy, he had them all helping him build these things. But he needed a name. And so he asked me to help him with a name. I said, I don't know, Murray, call anything you want to, you know. And he said, no, help me. I said, well, I can tell you this, Murray. In corporate America today, the trend is to be short and snappy and easy to remember and roll off the tongue. I said, it's no more General Motors, it's GM, it's Microsoft, it's Apple. You know, he said, I get that. What do you think I ought to use, you know? And so I grew up on a farm also, but both my parents had jobs. They had a college degree and had a job. We just had a little farm because my dad wanted us kids to work because he grew up working on the farm. And there was a little device there, a little motorized device, big now, like, you know, it's got tractor wheels on it and that type of stuff, you know. We don't even know what it was supposed to do, but my dad called it a boat truck. And so he'd say, we used it to kind of pull empty trailers around in a little job like that. It's easy to do that. And it was to hook it to the truck or hook it to the thing. So I said, you remember that, Murray? And he said, yeah, I remember that. And I said, well, there's nothing shorter, easier to do than Mojo. And so he called it a Mojo Mallard. In fact, if you get one of them original ones way out, there's a sticker on the motor. Now a sticker on the motor says Mojo Mallard. And it don't have any corporate name on it or anything back then. So he started making them, and however many they could make in a day, they would take to the sporting goods store at dark when they quit. The people that was next in line to get them would come to the sporting goods store that night and pick them up. So they never owned one for more than a day. And so they sell every one of them they could make every day. So that went on until the end of duck season. And when the end of duck season came, there was no further demand for them. So he quit doing that. But along the way, I kept telling him, I said, Murray, you ought to do this. You know, he had built a lot. Well, let me back up a little bit. His father and his brother that he was in farming business with died. Now, they were big farmers, lots of acres farming, big equipment, all that stuff, you know, had died. And so Murray got out of farming, and he liked to peddle that stuff. So he set up a shop, and he bought, you know, a bunch of the late model used wrecked cars. And, you know, he's supposed to be robbing parts out of them and rebuild them and all that stuff. He wasn't messing with them very much. I said, you ought to go and finish making these, because I can see this is going to be a big deal. He said, no, I don't want to do that, you know. So next time I asked him, man, I said, you ought to do that. He said, I don't want to do that. So I kind of figured out what his problem was. He don't like doing business. So one day I said, Murray, if you want to go in business doing that, I'll go in business with you. And he said, I'll do that. And so that's what got us going, you know. And a little interesting side piece is that we said, well, you can build them. I can set up a company. I can get it financed. I can get all that stuff done. It's no problem. I said, somebody got to sell them. And that's not me and you. I'm not a good salesman. You're not a good salesman. So let's get somebody. So actually, we thought about our buddy Phil Robinson, who you would know. And I said, well, the only thing wrong with that, Murray, the only person I know is worse selling than being used, Phil, because back in the early days, you couldn't talk to Phil about business. You had to go talk to Miss Kay. And Phil's a great guy, but he just don't like selling. So we went back to the sporting good guy. So the three of us formed a company. Actually, the company name, and we don't use it much, is called Huntwise, Inc. And so we formed a company to make those. And we started off making them the first year. We go through this little process of trying to figure out how many we can sell and can we make that many, make them all by hand. And anyway, the conclusion in the end was, well, we think we can sell 7,500 of them. And Murray said, I can make 7,500 of them. And I got to have some help. And when the year was over with, we had made and sold a little over 15,000. And wow. So you know, it turned out to be a good business. So after that, we started, you know, just transformed it into a real business. You know, we were kind of experimenting that first year. And so that's how Mojo got here.
Yeah. So it sounds like you guys found a problem or found a part of the market and made it better, over-engineered what was there and created your own unique line of products. And it started with the Mallard. And then how easy was it to transition into various types of products from the original Motion decoy?
Well, it wasn't just obvious to you, but it wasn't terribly difficult either. But You know, there wasn't a lot of knowledge around about what a spin-in wing decoy would do at that time. And so I know we made a dove in about our second year, and we really didn't know how attractive a dove was going to be to it or not. So we, you know, people didn't know a whole lot about the concept and, you know, why it worked and, you know, what it took to work and things like that. And it was all kind of developed by, you know, kind of by trial and error. And it didn't take too awful long for us to learn what is attracted to it and what is not attracted to it. Because doves are very, very attracted to it. And they don't live very long, so they don't live long enough to catch on to it. But, you know, geese don't like it at all, and oftentimes they're scared of it. You know, you run the geese off. That's why you see these guys at dry field hunt a lot where geese will be mixed up with the ducks. You know, that's what really brought the remote control into the spinning wing decoy, because they need to be able to turn it off when the geese are coming. And geese will land with them, but they probably won't more times than they will. So, you know, we learned that that dove are highly attracted to them. So it was easy for us to make a dove. You have to go mold a dove body and, you know, a whole different kind of motor because they're not very big. And then we mostly started expanding into different species and versions of a duck. You know, like we made a floating mallard that float on top of the water, and that was pretty popular because when it's on the stake, it's just sitting there in one spot all the time. And then when it's floating, it's moving around with the breeze and stuff like that. I really don't know how much that affects the ducks, but it's better for the human to sit there all morning and look at this. And then we got into accessories, and we developed some great accessories that for the most part didn't sell at that time. They were before their time. And that's been one of our bigger problems at Mojo. We try to stay on the cutting edge out front, and we get products that are just before their time. And we might like them, but the buying public doesn't necessarily like them. And so we weren't real successful with a lot of accessories then. I see a lot of accessories coming onto the market now. Some of them we built 20 years ago, and because their time has come. You know, right now the biggest trend in waterfowl is called some kind of movement of either your decoy or the water, make ripples, you know, that type of stuff. And if we get into duck hunting later, I will cover some of that in more detail. But, you know, it's always been a thought with us that wait a minute, you know, maybe we've gone as far as we can go doing what we're doing. But this is our 24th year. We started, that was 99 when Murray made the first Mojo Mallards, and we went in business in 20, so this is our 24th year, and that hasn't happened to us yet. And the reason that it hasn't is two. Well, one, we can branch out to other things other than spinning wing decoys, and number two, the basic rule in waterfowling is, as far as decoy goes, is make your decoys look like live ducks. Well, we're nowhere close to that today, you know, and I don't know if you'd ever get that or not, you know. So we'll get some video either that we shot or somebody else shot, doesn't matter, of live ducks sitting on the water or in a dry field, doesn't matter, and they're perfectly at ease. They're not alert to you being there or anything like that, and they make a tremendous amount of motion and noise quacking, noise splashing on the water, you know. And if you can duplicate that, then, you know, you could decoy ducks much better than you can decoy today. So that's pretty much an endless array of things that you can do, but they get more high tech. And to make your decoys look like live ducks would be really high tech, and it's really not something I'd want to do from a hunting point of view. I'd want to do it from a product development point of view, but from a hunting point of view, I just really don't want my decoy to be quite that high tech.
Now, from the original models that you guys started with to what you have on the market today, how much changes have been made to that original design?
Well, the original one, it had a motor bolted to the inside of a decoy. It took a hollow decoy, cut the top out of it. About the third year, we molded our own decoy, but up to then, we used off-the-shelf decoys. We tried to find one. It was kind of sort of in a landing position, but there wasn't really one that was quite like that. That's why we found it molded our own. You know, it had a battery in there. in the beginning, you know, we had a 6-volt battery just laid in the bottom of the decoy, and it had a switch, you know, and that was it. That was all it was to it, you know, and it wasn't much to go wrong in that. And then as time went on, those things started to appear to be, you know, pretty crude, and they were, but they worked really well. So we started refining it, and other companies that got into the business started refining theirs too, you know. And we went to the Elite Series next, and in the Elite Series, we designed a housing. This was my design now. We designed a housing, a plastic structural housing that had the motor and the battery and everything in it, and the peg that fits it on the pole. And we just wrapped a semi-flexible body around that. So you didn't even have to have the body. In fact, we'll film sometimes with one with the body off, just to demonstrate, you know, hey, this is an independent unit. It's not dependent upon the body. Because when you hook the motor to the body like we did in the beginning, you know, that's just a poor way of transmitting, you know, power to something. You think about, you know, what if your motor in your car was hooked to the body, your bicycle, your motorcycle, it don't matter what, it wouldn't work. You couldn't go down the road with it like that. So I always thought, well, you needed a structural frame, because I'm an engineer, I got that engineering thought process. You need a structural frame to hook the motor to, and the body needs to be independent and probably on shock absorbers, just like a vehicle is. So it worked a long time, you know, to work that out, and we developed this the Elite Series. But along the way, people keep saying, well, bring out that old Mojo Mallard again. Don't you make that Mojo Mallard again? And so they kept saying that until, last year, we brought out the Mojo Mallard again, but with modern technology. It's not built like that. The motor is not hooked to the body, you know, and it has built-in remote and all that other type stuff. And so we've actually come a big circle, and we're back almost to where we were, but with great improvement. You know, it's not like the old Mojo Mallard. It would vibrate a lot. You know, it had metal wings, because if you remember, I said Murray wrapped race cars with sheets of aluminum. So that's what he did. He cut the wings out of those sheets of aluminum that he had. And they're actually better, because what you're trying to do is reflect light. If you understand the principle of spinning wing decoy, you're trying to reflect light from one side and not from the other side. And so he used that because it's what he had in hand, but it turned out to be the, you know, the very best material if you could make a spinning wing decoy.
Yeah, it sounds like he made two very good decisions when he was engineering the product from the beginning that kind of saved you probably a lot of trial and error work. You talked about the RPMs and how fast those wings are spinning. How much work went into studying what worked, what didn't, as far as speeds through the years?
Yeah. And through the years is when we did it, you know, he just hit up on it. You know, I don't know that he had some thought about that, but I don't know that he didn't have thought about that either. But we didn't know a whole lot about what made them work. We knew how they worked, not what made them work, but we studied. And speed is something that a lot of hunters that I talk to don't ever think about. It's not that they couldn't understand it, they don't ever think about it, but and you can't really have an absolute minimum speed, because it's going to vary a good bit on what your main wings made out of, how good it reflects light. Coroplast wings are real popular today, but they're not the most reflective thing in the world, you know, so they're really not the best, but they turn out they're the most economical, they're the most durable, but they're not the best at reflecting light, so you lose a little bit doing that. But I studied it over the years. In fact, the first few years I carried a voltmeter with me when I go hunting, and I checked the voltage in my decoy as it depleted as the morning went on, or the day went on, it would deplete. And up until lithium ion batteries, you know, you start discharging a CO lead acid battery, which is mostly what we used, or a nickel metal hayride like most double A's are, or alkaline or whatever. Once you put an amp draw on them, they start losing voltage. And remember, the DC motors turn in proportion to the voltage that you're pushing to it, so it starts losing speed. And I just kind of came out with a generalized number that it needs to turn 400 RPMs or more. And generally speaking, the faster the better. We try to design most everything we do to be like 700, 750 RPMs. That gives you a pretty good leeway in there before you hit the bottom of it. Now, once it goes under whatever the number is, whether I'm right or wrong, once it goes under that, the hunter can't tell by looking at it. But the ducks can, and they're not nearly attracted to it. And one of the mistakes that occurred, nobody's at fault on this, but one of the mistakes that occurred with spinning wing decoys from the beginning was that their highest and best use was and always was, always will be, long range attraction, because the duck can see that strobe, that flash that the spinning wing decoy makes. If it's turning fast enough, they can see it further than they can see anything else. And but once it gets down to where it don't generate that flash, they can't. And so, you know, we try to preach to the hunters, you know, keep your speed up, keep your speed up on this thing. But in the early beginnings, the ducks want to come land right on top of them. And so that made people think of them as a finishing device. You know, they didn't think about the long range attraction. They thought about, hey, man, they'll come land right in your decoy, right where you want them to, you know. And that was true, but it's not true today to the extent that it was back then, because they kind of catch on to, you know, to the concept of that. And I believe that once a duck gets pretty close to, let's say, inside 100 yards, then they can tell that's too much flash for a duck, that the duck just can't do that much flash. And so they learn to kind of shy away from them, you know. So if we would have educated the hunters in the early beginning to that, the use of spinning wing decoys would be more effective today than it actually is among the hunting population.
So your battery source chart, when you guys were originally engineering and the kind of playing around with this, was just a 6-volt battery, correct? And then now you're probably using maybe double A's or even solar, I guess, double A's?
Well, in the beginning, the very first ones of the Mojo Mallards, and actually for a long, long time, they weren't sold with a battery. You'd buy 6-volt Leonard battery, you know, just any old 6-volt again, plug it up. It had little alligator clips on the end of the wire. You just clip it to them little deal, you know, and that's how it worked. But then all those lose voltage, you know, as they go. And, but probably maybe in our third or fourth year, somewhere along that, I go back to the catalogs and tell this. So we started furnishing with a seal lead acid battery. And, and they were great. They're great batteries and rechargeable. And so you know, you didn't have to keep buying batteries, just recharge the thing at night and do it over again. But seal lead acid or lead acid, whether it's sealed or unsealed, lead acid, same batteries in your car, truck, as you know, it does lose voltage with amp draw. So it's going to diminish as the day goes on. The original old Mojo Mallard, as it worked out, it would make about a 100 RPMs per volt. So when you charge up that 6-volt battery, it's going to start out something a little over 6 volts. So it was turning probably 600 something RPMs. It was very, very effective. But once it got down to 4 volts, from there on, it's going to get below the 400 RPMs, and it's not very effective. And I know a lot of hunters let that happen because they don't know not to. And so that's why I say we did not do a good job of educating them about that. And but it's something a hunter, a duck hunter, if they want to use a spinning wing decoy, they should constantly think about that.
Hey, let me interrupt this podcast episode real quick and talk about huntinggeardeals.com. If you're interested in saving money on hunting gear, there's no better place on the web. Basically, what huntinggeardeals.com does is scour the web for discounted products on hunting gear and shares them in one convenient location. So type in huntinggeardeals.com in your web browser and sign up for the daily deal email, so you never miss a deal. Now, back to the show. So if I've got a spread of decoys out here, and I'm sure this varies based on species and location and stuff, but how many spinning wing decoys versus non-spinning wing decoys should I have in my set?
Well, in my years of waterfowl hunting, I've learned one thing. You got to let the ducks tell you.
Okay.
But the more you hunt, the more you can make a better first guess. But there are days when if you put out, say, 8 and you will kill ducks. Ducks will come. And if you put out one or two, they will not. There are some days when they don't want that much flash. And, you know, we don't have a great definition of that, but we know it had a lot to do with the sky condition. If you have a low ceiling, then you're going to need less flash. I think that flash is bouncing off the bottom of that ceiling and kind of scaring the bird. They don't want to come around it. If you got a clear bluebird day, then you probably can't have too much flash out there. And so we have actually done that. But the average hunter don't own 8 mojos, and so we don't. You know, some days you can put them on a high pole, and we make a high extension pole, and the ducks just love it. And some days they don't want it up that high. So, you know, my standard rule is you got to let the ducks tell you. But in order for the ducks to tell you, you got to talk to them first. So it takes a little while, you know, each day to get to that point. But you get a little better as you hunt longer at knowing what you should do in the beginning.
Okay, so as somebody that's never waterfowl hunted, I'll say that right off the top so the listeners know. Like, I've never picked up a shotgun and went and killed a winged duck, goose, anything like that. So what's going to be more important for somebody starting out? Calling to these birds or trying to fool them into thinking there's birds already there without the noise?
Well, I couldn't really say which one of those would be more important. You need both of them.
Okay.
You need to call to attract them from a long distance, even if they see your spinning wing from a long distance off. You know, you next got to talk them into believing that those are real ducks. You know, and that's the real issue in decoying waterfowl of any kind, is convincing them that these are real ducks sitting there. So you need to call to do that. The most important thing about calling is you need to learn when not to call, probably more than you need to learn when to call. And then somewhat the same about your decoy spreading. You know, you need to learn how to make it look like real ducks. You know, you need to learn where to put your mojos. And if ducks aren't pressured, they haven't been hunted much. Say you're up in Canada or up even up there where you guys are at. You know, they haven't been hunted like they have when they hit the lower Mississippi River, you know. You can put your spinning wing decoy right in your killing hole. Because you're going to range your decoys, you know, such that you got an open hole or mostly open hole right in front of you, what we call a killing hole. Okay, so you want them to lay in there, that's your best shot at them, you know. You can put your spinning wing, you put your mojo right in that killing hole. But as they get a little more cautious, you know, they start knowing what a call is. They start knowing what a duck blind looks like. You know, they start knowing what a spinning wing decoy is. Then you have to learn to kind of move those things further out. You have to learn how to make your decoys look like ducks would look that day. And, you know, there are some places where people put out 1,500 decoys. You know, you go to the other extreme, that's usually big water, great big water. And you go to the other stream towards the end of the season, toward the end of our season now. You know, we're the last ones. You know, they get what you call a decoy shy. They just get to where they're checking much more closely at your setup to see if they think it's real ducks, as they've been hunted and burned in that business, you know. And then sometimes people won't put out but a dozen decoys. But you got to give the ducks what they want. You can't get away from that rule. You got to do that.
Okay. So you've got this spinning wing decoy. What are some of the issues or hurdles that you had to overcome? I would imagine one of them would be having the fact that you're dealing with water. Waterfowl hunting's water, so you got to make sure these motors and the battery sources are probably watertight in order for them to work, correct?
Well, it's not incorrect, but we didn't exactly do it that way. You know, we took a decoy in the beginning and, you know, cut a hole in the back, put a motor and a battery and switch in it. So it certainly wasn't waterproof, but we had extremely durable motors, and that's one of the things that separated us from the rest of the crowd, because these original Mojo Mallards, we've done it. We've had all kind of people tell us they've done it. They've let it fall in the water. They didn't get it out till spring. And for the most part, it's still run. So that had to be attended to. You're exactly right about that. But there wasn't until we started molding our own bodies and, you know, doing all that type work, you know, it really wasn't any reasonable way, a realistic way, or practical way, I guess would be a better word, you know, to really accomplish that. So what you had to do is rely upon extremely durable electrical components.
Okay. Now, I had a podcast guest talk about Waterfowl and how they use, like, what the words he used, I don't want to mess it up, but basically like electric magnetic fields or something that birds utilize for kind of homing or flight patterns and stuff like that. Does that sound right or familiar?
Well, that theory is out there. I don't know a whole lot about it. I can't tell you a whole lot about it, but, you know, there's been a lot of study in the last, 20, 30 years is how birds migrate because they know exactly where they want to go to, how that's done. And you hear a magnetic field, you know, you hear all kind of different stuff. You know, I know people are playing with that. It'd be real interesting to see what the answer is in the end, but I know they have a mechanism that allows them to go exactly where they want to go, thousands of miles away, and then turn around and go back to where they were hatched or where they bred the year before. I don't know exactly how they do it, but they can do it. I just don't have a lot of knowledge about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's above my pay grade, just that's for sure. I think I seen a study the other day that I can't remember what state it was, and they had these birds with caught GPSs on them and stuff, and they clocked one at 103 miles per hour. And I'm just thinking, how in the world is this one bird just catching a tailwind? And I mean, 103 miles per hour through the sky, you can cover some ground real quick. Birds that you guys are hunting at the end of season, heck, that bird could have been in my backyard a couple days before that.
Absolutely. You know, going a few hundred miles is nothing to them. I don't know. There's a report, I've read it quite a few times. It may be more than one instance where a commercial airline pilot saw a goose up there and he was at 35,000 feet. So how's a goose get enough oxygen at 35,000 feet to be flying? I don't know. Birds are amazing creatures and so are ducks. I've studied ducks' eyesight and things like that a good bit through my years, and you know, they have some amazing abilities.
But that was kind of one thing that I wanted to ask. Like, you talked about the long range attraction that a motion decoy brings in, but how far away can ducks actually see a decoy spread? How careful do I need to be as a hunter when I'm sitting in a blind or on the bank or wherever I may be? Do you know much about a bird's vision?
Well, I've studied it. I wouldn't claim to know much about it, but I've studied it. Okay. Yeah. And they have amazing eyesight. You know, they can change the shape of their eye and see, you know, in different direct, pick up objects in different directions. They have a lot more nerves and blood vessels going to their eye than we do. However, they are prey species, so they have their eyes on the side of their head, so they're not seeing the same thing with both eyes. So they don't have very good depth perception. They really can't tell how big something is. But, you know, there's some interesting things you find out when you hunt and you study about birds' eyesight. You know, they do detect motion. To answer your specific question, we do not really know how far they can see a spinning wing decoy, but we know it's for miles. And, you know, if a human is within reasonable proximity of that spinning wing decoy, say a couple hundred, under a couple hundred yards, you see the flash happening, but you really don't see what the bird sees. But if you get like a quarter of a mile away from that spinning wing decoy, you can't even see the decoy or anything like that. You think it's a strobe, looks like it's a strobe light over there flashing. And they can see that from a long, long way. And it's miles. I don't know how many miles it is. We had a crop duster tell us he could see a mojo at 8 miles because he knew where the mojo was. And of course, being a crop duster, you know, he knew where he was. He said, it's 8 miles. I can see that. He said, it looks like strobe light. That's all I see. It looks like strobe light. Huh. And so they can see that. So, you know, that's why I say that its highest and best use always going to be long range attraction, because that bird that's flying at that distance from you, he can't see your decoy spread from that far off. Now, birds are said to be able to see moving objects, just moving objects, something moving back and forth, about 3.5 times better than they can see still objects. Now, I don't know who came up with 3.5 times and how they did it, but and I don't know whether to believe that or not, but they can see it a lot better. You know, I can tell you that if something moves, they can see it a lot better. But they can't see it. They can't see it for miles. And one of the most interesting things that you will notice, if you get out, wait out in the decoys, for move the decoys, whatever, the birds tend to come at that time. And they will fly up there 100 yards, 150 yards, before they ever figure out that, you know, you're in danger. Or if you send the decoy, the dog out to pick up a duck, you know, they'll do the same thing. And I've killed water ducks by just bending over to where I don't look like a human, and they get close enough that I could kill them that way, you know. So it's kind of hard to see. You read all this stuff, it tells you how great the duck's eyesight is, and then you sit there and watch them fly up within 75 yards of you when you're standing up in the middle of the decoy. So that's kind of contradictory, and it has to be. They have great eyesight, but it's different than ours. You know, we try to compare everything to us, and that's a, you know, that's a natural response there. But it's different than ours. But they do have great eyesight.
Yeah, I mean, one of the key things you said there is actually something I wrote in a blog post not too long ago. But it was the difference in eyesight for predator species versus prey species, and how what kind of vision and options they have to their sides or the peripherals is what we have, but being able to see things from a different perspective and a greater range of motion without actually having to turn their heads and stuff is always very intriguing from somebody that starts studying that.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, they all obviously evolved to have the eyesight that they need to survive. Take a white-tailed deer, for instance. You know, he can't smell you. You stand there within 100 yards of him. If you don't move, he just stares at you. He knows you're something odd or different, but he don't figure out you're a human until you move or he gets a whiff of you or something like that. But, you know, I did a little work on eyes of whitetail, you know, but they, you know, they have more rods or spheres or whichever one it is. They can gather a lot of light. They can see motion real good, but they don't really see that well. They see motion and they see, and they get a light. And so that's just nature at work.
Yeah, it's the adaptation to what they're designed to survive with.
Absolutely, survival.
So if I'm a first-time waterfowl hunter, and there's a lot of different species of ducks out there, many of which I don't even know by name what they are or how to identify them. But as I'm looking through the website, I see all these different model ducks. Do I need to have a specific mallard decoy if I want to kill a mallard duck, or will they kind of intermix and kind of blend together in the spread and attract more than one species of ducks?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of people only have mallard decoys simply because that's the most common duck that we have over most of the U.S. and Canada, Mexico. And so they would have that. And yes, other ducks will come to those decoys. I do believe that it helps to have a decoy of the species that you are targeting, if you are targeting a species, you know. Down where we live, we have some of them all, you know. So I think there's a little difference between puddle ducks and diving ducks. Like if you want to target diving ducks, I think you probably need some diving duck decoys. You know, pintail is a popular bird. We haven't been able to kill very many of them in the last few years. They're a wary duck. And so I've hunted a lot of times with mallard decoys, except I'd have 6 or 8 pintail decoys, and I'd put them on a group right out on the point of it. So then pintails see those pintail decoys, they could recognize them real easy. You know, they would come to them. And if you hunt a lot, you know, and hunting duck hunting's a big deal to you, and you got a lot of different species, you could kind of mix them up. But most people hunt more if they're in an area with a lot of mallards, where mallards are predominant duck, they'll hunt with just mallard decoys, nothing else. So
okay,
it's better if you can, but it's not necessary.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm wondering. So, like, if I'm a whitetail hunter, is an elk decoy going to do me any good if I'm standing behind it versus whitetail decoy? So that was kind of the somebody that's looking to waterfowl hunt this year is like, if I want to kill geese, do I need goose decoys or do I need mallard decoys? So
I've made a lot of hunts where we were hunting ducks mostly, but we only put out goose decoys. And that's because they big and they seal so much better. Again, it's about to attract them. If a wild duck or a wild waterfowl bird, whatever it might be, is sitting on the water there, that tells the duck that's looking for a place to come to that it's safe there. And I would think that that's his first checklist point. You know, is it safe for me to land there? Now, if he's going to feed, he needs to go to a place where he can feed. You know? And if he's just going to loaf or roost, then he needs to go to a good place to roost or loaf. But he got to determine that it's safe to be there. Yeah. And most any kind of bird to do that. One of the best, if not the best, confidence decoy is a coot. You know, coot's one of the fastest flying birds there are. They're not a duck, by the way. They are a waterfowl, they're not a duck, you know. But once they come to a place and land, you can't only make them fly. You know, you scare them enough, they get up 2 or 3 feet off the water and fly off. And so they mostly just swim around, you know, after they land in some place till they get ready to move to another. But if there's something they don't like, they just swim off. So if they're there, there's nothing there to bother them.
Okay. So somebody starting out, like maybe I need to look into picking up one of those decoys and adding to the arsenal as a pro tip there.
Yeah. It'll make a difference.
Okay. So as far as Mojo waterfowl decoys are concerned, is there anything else we should know about it when it comes time to make a buying decision? What model to go with or what species, anything like that before we move on to some of the other products that Mojo offers?
But the quirk of human nature is they're going by the price point. And for instance, if you bought one of those original Mojo mallards, we still got them 20 years later that's working, okay? Well, they cost about twice what our price point decoy works, you know? And it's a price point decoy. You know, if you get 2 or 3 years out of it, that's about as much you're going to get. Well, if you figured out by the numbers, it'd been much cheaper to buy that high-end decoy. It's going to be cheaper in the long run. But the fact is, you got to put the money out up front, you know. And some people can go buy a price point decoy when they can't buy high-end decoy. So it's about like anything else, you know. If you buy shoes, you know, you can buy them high-end shoes, they'll last forever, you know. So most of us don't do that, though. We just buy, you know, something kind of in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said with value, not necessarily cost. I mean, if I'm paying $50 for a product and I'm getting a good life cycle out of it, then I feel like I got my money's worth. Mm-hmm. But if I can pay $500 for it and never have to worry about replacing it and I know that's an extreme cost as far as decoys, but as an example, some of the pair of boots that I've got, you brought up boots, like there's some $500 pair of boots out there that I can wear for years and years and years. Or there's other brands of boots that cost me $200 that before hunting season goes, I have to replace them because they've got an odor that I can't get rid of or they've deteriorated over time. So what I've found is quality doesn't always reflect price, but man, when you get a good value for the product, it's always worth it.
Absolutely. And even in these decoys, we try to put as much quality in our price point decoy as we do the other, but you know, the fact that it is got a much smaller motor, you know, it's got Corplast wings. And they're good wings, but they're not as durable as metal wings is. So it's value. That's exactly what it is. This brand new Mojo Mallard I was telling you about that we just came back out with, you know, you can't hardly make it not run. I wouldn't be surprised to see people hunt with it for 20 years, except they want the latest thing. So when the latest thing comes out after that, you know, they'll want to buy that. And it's a $180-something decoy. But that's value. If you made 10 years with it, you make more than that. But if you made 10, you only spend $18 a year. Exactly. But you had to spend $180-something to start with, though. That's what causes it.
What is the life cycle of that product and how much is it going to cost you on an annual basis?
That's correct.
Go buy a $10,000 vehicle and then get 1 year out of it, or I buy a $100,000 vehicle and then get 10 years out of it. It's the same price if I'm buying that vehicle every year at $10,000. So,
can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
does that mean that that truck I just paid $75,000 for and it's exactly like the one I bought right before COVID and I only paid $45,000 for it? Does that mean it's a better or worse bargain?
So I just bought a new truck this year out of necessity. I had a nice Lariat F-150. It rode good. It felt good inside of it. But man, there was something nice about having a brand new truck with a new suspension, better off-road tires, and it handled so much better, even though it was 5 or 6 years difference and had similar technology. Sometimes those little bells and whistles make a big difference on the comfort and the drive when we're behind the wheel.
It does that. Now, the new truck I got, it really does do that. Yep. And it's kind of hard to think about paying $75 for a pickup truck.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I bought a trimmer this year, and it's a nice vehicle, but man, it sure hurt when I was spending all that money.
So, value, but you got value.
Value, yeah. So I got a tax deduction that I can help recuperate some of that expense there with those miles. So.
And value has a whole lot to do with more things than money.
It does, absolutely. The experience, like for instance, I do a lot of deer hunting. And somebody asked, like, why in the world would you spend $2,000 on a crossbow? I've shot a lot of crossbows. I never hunted with one, but I got married. My wife had a kid coming in, so I got a stepson now. And I wanted to introduce him to the hunting culture that I'm used to, and he wasn't ready for a compound bow. So I got him a crossbow. And I thought, if I was going to shoot a crossbow, am I going to go buy this cheap crossbow that I'm going to have to worry about blowing up? Am I going to have issues with it? Is it going to be loud? Is it not going to be fun to shoot? Or am I going to invest in something that's worth me buying? So I kicked around the ideas. I could have bought 5 crossbows for what I paid for this one for him, but I bought him the nicer one. His confidence level, my confidence level in him when he's ready to take that shot far outweighed that upfront cost. And I haven't had to put strings on it yet. I hadn't had any work on it. But I know every time he pulls that trigger, the scope's on and it's ready to do its job. And that's just one example of perceived value versus the actual cost. There's a lot of products out there that I've purchased that were really cheap on sale, and I've got my money's worth out of it. There's a lot of money products out there that I've purchased through the years that turned out to be a dud, and they cost a lot of money. One of those is being some cameras that I bought, cellular trail cameras. Some of the best on the market, I got a year out of them. Some of the cheapest on the market, I've gotten 10 years out of. So it just depends on, is that a quality product that you're bringing to the table? And Mojo being in business since 99 is when you guys started, comes to speak of value and the quality product that you've brought. You talked about the original decoys that you made still being usable today if you could get your hands on one. So congratulations on bringing value to this industry year after year and being a good investment for waterfowl hunters through the years.
Thank you for saying that. I appreciate that. We really do try. It bugs me to death. Try, you know, to make the very best product we can make. But, you know, you only got so much money that you can spend on every product. You know, it has a price that it'll sell for. It won't sell above that price, you know. And so you got to figure out how to make the best product you can with the budget that you have to work with.
Yeah, so not only do I do this podcast with Dan and stuff, but I also own huntinggeardeals.com. So my job is to help connect the consumer with the best price on that particular product when it goes on sale. Memorial Day, for instance, is coming up. And some products have MAP pricing and they never go on sale, whereas some products, the only time you're going to find them on discounted, Black Friday, maybe Memorial Day, Labor Day, things like that. So being able to shop around, find the best deal. Maybe it's a clearance price product because you're in a market to where you guys sell direct, which on your website, I think you guys sell direct. You don't have to put your products on sale, but if they're in a box store, they might be moving inventory out. So if you buy during the off season, you talked about in the beginning of supply and demand when you waterfowl season was over, nobody wanted to buy them. So you slowed down and kind of figured out what you wanted to do for the following year. That's when all this stuff goes on sale hunting wise is after season. So for us, turkey season's winding down, and I know big box stores like Walmart and other places, they're going to be wanting to move inventory off the shelves and make room for the next season that's coming out. So that's what I try to do, is connect people at the right time to save money, not necessarily in peak buying season.
Sure. Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
So for us right now, turkey season's winding down, and my first experience with a Mojo decoy was actually turkey decoys. We were in Henrietta, Texas at the World Championship Turkey Hunt.
Turkey Fest.
Turkey Fest.
I've done it about four or five times. We didn't do it this year, yeah.
Okay, I didn't get the chance to do it this year. So my team actually, one year, we won the biggest bird, the heavyweight bird. You get the belt buckle on this thing. So that was a really cool experience. But Mojo had some decoys there. You all had supplied some decoys. And the kid that we brought with us, Weston, he was, golly, 10, 12 years old. Probably one of the best turkey callers and great little turkey hunter I've ever been in the woods with. He wanted that decoy. So he bought that decoy. The next day we had a chance to hunt. Here's Weston out in the middle of this field, moving that Mojo scoot and shoot back and forth, calling, and he called in two birds for me on a string. Just one of the most beautiful hunts you could ever see. And that little bottom, fog lifting up, turkeys gobbling, and he brought those birds in with that Mojo scoot and shoot like nothing else. Those birds would never have come across if he was not able to work that bird with it behind that Mojo scoot and shoot. They would not have came to a fixed position decoy had they not been using that. So that was my first experience with a Mojo decoy, and I've kind of been infatuated with them ever since.
That is the most exciting way to call a turkey up and kill it.
Yeah. So, and Weston was so little. I mean, 10, 12 year old. He's a little kid. So he was completely hidden behind this decoy. And if we could have had it on film, it would have been beautiful footage. But at the time, we were just trying to feel those tags before we hopped on our flight. And that was a great experience. Really enjoyed hunting down there. And I hope to get back next year in line. So I threw my name in the hat for next year when they're ready to put some teams together and defend that title.
Yeah, we've done that too for next year. We didn't get to do it the last couple of years. The schedule just didn't allow for us to. But we told them that if they'll let us in, we'll come next year. So I don't know what'll happen.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I put my name in the hat too, so we might be competing against each other next year.
There you go.
Small world. What's the chances of that, huh?
Yeah, really, yeah.
So so let's talk about some turkey decoys. You've been able to bring in, you revolutionized the industry with a better product with the spinning wing duck decoys, and then it naturally progresses into other products and other genres. So how have you been able to apply this other than the dove decoy, which is a smaller frame, smaller motor, same process, but in other applications, whether it be predator, turkey, things of that nature?
Well, you know, we have a commercial. I don't think we run it now. We say it's showing the things that we consider that we have revolutionized that kind of hunting. And it's it starts off with duck. It goes to dove. It goes to predator. And with predator, we make a predator decoy. That's the little furry top on a, looks like a speedometer cable. And it changed predator calling up to then. But I studied and I talked to all the old predator callers I could talk to about whether they use decoys or not. And decoys were not very popular. And I'd ask them why not. And they say, well, that sometimes they work, sometimes they scare the predator. You know, they cost too much, they're too hard to carry around. And so I said, okay, I got that. And so you know, you got to make one that's effective. It don't scare the thing. It's economical. It's portable, you know. So I took those rules, and we did two or three of them before we ever hit on this one. But it really did revolutionize predator calling, and almost everybody's selling predator electronic calls now have copied us and put that decoy in their product also, you know. So that was something that I got into mostly because I like to call predators. And so I said, well, I'm in a decoy business. I like to call predators, need a predator decoy, you know. It was kind of a logical thing that we did. And so we changed predator calling, you know, when we did that. And let's see if I have another category there that we should put it in. The most effective one that we've had is the one you said, the dove. You know, it probably changed dove hunting more than we've changed any other sport, with the possible exception of duck hunting. And now we come out with the, you know, the scoot and shoot decoy. We didn't invent that style of turkey hunting by any means. In fact, they tell me that they're pretty sure the Native Americans used it, you know, back a couple hundred years ago. And they probably did, because all they was interested in is killing something, because that was survival to them. But we're the first person that brought it out to the market and made it popular. So we certainly revolutionized part of turkey hunting doing that. We have a new turkey decoy this year. It's a hen. I can't say it's revolutionary, but it has a rather complex structural housing up in it that'll let you mount it in two different places, head down or head up. You know, we just rotate it. You know, that's all you got to do is rotate it up. Or it's designed to sit flat on the ground like a breeding hen. So hey, that's not going to revolutionize turkey hunting, but it does bring an added element to turkey decoys. And it's a high end, from a looks point of view, it's a high end decoy.
Yeah, it's a beautiful decoy when you zoom in and you actually look at the details and that goes into it. They look great. It's not a cheaply made decoy at all. It's a beautiful decoy.
Absolutely, it is. Yeah.
So, one thing that is different with the predator decoys versus the other decoys is you're combining two different features. You're combining the calling as well as the movement. I'm going to play dumb on this one because I kind of am. I would imagine that you can't incorporate the calling with waterfowl into the decoy because it's the electronic side of it. Is that illegal?
Yeah, it's against the Fed rule.
That's what I figured.
You can't have anything that artificially calls a duck.
Okay. Yeah, that's what somebody's never duck hunted. I kind of figured that was a rule because I know, like, in my state, you can't have electronic turkey calls and you can't have electronic deer calls. I just assume waterfowl was the same way, but predators, you're able to do that.
Yeah, in a turkey and whatever, it's a state by state selection.
Yeah,
in Texas, you can use electronic calls to call turkeys, and but most states you can't. In fact, I don't know if there is another state, but they're not. They can't be more than a couple of them that let you use electronic calls for turkeys. But most states will let you use electronic calls for predators. You know, because predators have become such a problem. A nuisance, a big cost to agriculture that, most states have loosened it up to where you can use any kind of call you want. You can do it at night, you can use thermal, you can shoot them from the air, you can do all kind of different things. So it's kind of wide open as far as doing that. But like I say, when Mojo was in its first few years, callers didn't use decoys because they didn't think they worked. So once we finally hit upon one by trial and error that did work, then they became very popular. And for several years, we just made the decoy, not the collar. And then we the first people that combined the decoy and the collar. Now quite a few of them are doing that. But there's a couple different styles of predator calling. And this is a generality. So, some people just want to call them up out there at 100 yards, and shoot them. That's all they want to do, rifle shoot them, In fact, I got some friends, they want to call them to 800 yards and shoot them. They were long-range shooters, And so they wanted to go hunting with me. And I said, okay, you can go hunting with me. We're going to call it up at 35 yards, shoot it with a shot. No, we ain't going to do that. We're going to shoot 800 yards. Then you're not going hunting with me because I'm not doing what I do. We kind of specialize in calling them up, right in their lap and shotgunning them. Even though I was a rifle hunter to start with, I didn't want to be a shotgun hunter. But once we developed that decoy, once that especially coyote, bobcat tube, fox tube, but especially coyote, once he locks onto it, he don't want to leave it alone. And he run right up to it, until he smells something man or he smells or hears something mechanical or something like that, So we killed most of them well under 50 yards. So there's two different views of what they want to do is the point of all of that, So if you just want to call them up to 100, 200 yards or 800 yards, you just put your collar there where you're at and do that. And in fact, you can stay in a vehicle if you only want to call them up to 800 yards if you're in open country, But we don't do that, We want to call them up right to the collar. And so we put our collar out about 35 yards in front of us, and try to get the coyote or whatever predator we're doing to come right up to it, and they will.
Yeah, I had a chance this year during turkey season. Is I didn't have a collar. I was using a mouth or a slate call or something, and I called in three coyotes, of course, coming into the decoy, and they surrounded that decoy from every direction. And that can be fun, shotgunning coyotes from the ground. That's a lot of work to try to swing from one coyote to the next, get reloaded.
It is.
That's a fun time. So other than what we've talked about, as somebody that's going to be hopefully going waterfowl hunting for the first time this season, what do I need to know? What are some basic tips you can give me with all your years of experience to help get me started on the right track?
Well, you know, first of all, you need to have a place that ducks like to come to. There's three basic rules of waterfowl. Number one is be where ducks want to be. I'm going to use ducks, but it could be any waterfowl. Be where ducks want to be. Number two is be hid. Number three is make your decoy spread look like live ducks. Now, number three is where we come in. But I can tell you, if you can pull off number one and two, you don't even need a decoy. If they want to come there anyway, all you got to do is be hidden and just sit there and shoot them. And that'll happen to you, but it won't happen to you very often. And so that cannot be your hunting plan, you know. So you need to have a place ducks like to come to, because ducks have very specific places that they like to come to. Even on a bigger body of water, they just like this one point. And it will change with weather sometimes, and especially with the wind, it'll change with the wind. So you need to kind of study all of that. Of course, you're going to have to set up with the wind either at your back or the wind, you know, to the side, you know, because the duck is generally speaking not going to come right over your head and land in a decoy if you're facing the wind. So that's a bad no-no. Don't do that, you know. You know, and after that, you know, even though duck hunting has become an equipment intensive sport, you know, you don't have to have, you know, thousands of dollars worth of stuff. You know, you can take a dozen mallard decoys and do pretty good, you know, on a lot of days. Maybe you won't do good on every day. If you have a spinning wing decoy, you're going to do better than if you don't have one. That's been proven by studies by quite a few different states. And it's that long range attraction that really does it. Now, a lot of people, you know, once they get pressured and they don't want to land right next to one, they don't take them with them anymore. And that's a mistake. And I'm the wrong messenger for that, because I make them, but it really doesn't affect how many I would make or how many I sell. But I have the appearance of being the wrong messenger for that, you know. But if they don't want to come right close to them, put them over to the side or back behind you or wherever you want to put them. At least don't give up that long range attraction thing. And the other thing is that I said earlier the trick to it in the end is to make the ducks, the real birds, the live birds, think that your decoys are real ducks, you know. And, you know, that's motion mostly. You can't, and calling, you can't use electronic calling, as we just discussed, you know. It's mostly the ducks move, the decoys moving around to where they look alive. The calling sounds like a real duck, you know. You know, and after that, it pretty much boils down to what we call wood skills. Where you at, you probably call them wood skills too, but, you know, well, there's not woods everywhere, you know. When I learned to say that, I only hunted in the woods. I never hunted anything else, because the better your wood skills are, said better your outdoor skills get, you'll figure out what to use. But, you know, I talk to a lot of hunters, and I always try to, you know, tell them this. I said, look, if you knew it hunting, and you're not real experienced, you don't have to be new, you're just not real experienced, you know, and you get out there and you don't know what to do, you know, don't start thinking, I don't know what to do, but these other people do, because that's not true. None of us do that. Obviously, you're a very experienced hunter, you know. None of us know exactly what we ought to do at any one given time, you know, and often you only got a half a second to think about it, you know. And so I try to encourage new hunters, don't do that. Don't start saying, well, I don't know what to do, you know. Shoot your best shot at it. As you get more experience at hunting in general, at wood skills, outdoor skills, your best shot will get to be better and more accurate on and on. So, you know, I find that in new hunters, they think that they should know things that they do not know. And then that's not necessarily true. But the more experience they get, you know, the more they will know. But other than that, you know, the best thing I tell you to do is get some decoys and go hunting. If you wanted to accelerate your learning curve, you could go to somebody that does know, just join somebody on a duck hunt. That's an excellent way to hunt. And every time something happens, ask them why they did that. And you probably won't get invited back after you spend all morning asking them, but you'll learn a lot of stuff on that one morning.
Yeah, that was so. I went on a guided fishing trip one year, and the guy that I was talking to, he waves his hand at this guy and says hi to him as we're driving by, and he said, "This guy here," he said, "he started a guide business after going on like a dozen guided trips with me, asking me questions on how I was doing things, how I was rigging it, why I was fishing where we were at." And he said, "We weren't there to just catch fish to bring them back with. He was there to learn the process." And he said, "Now he's sitting here building a business." We can apply that same principles to hunting as far as individuals by going with an experienced partner, like a mentor, and getting those basic knowledge skills and then even some in-depth tips and insider tricks in the field before you ever step and try to do it on your own. I think today's society is a lot of DIY stuff. Everybody wants to prove that you can go to public land and do it yourself. But the best hunters I know, yeah, a lot of them had to figure it out on their own, but they had a mentor that got them started. And I can say that for myself. Somebody lit that fire in me and provided those basic steps and necessities to get me to where I'm at today. But take the time to give that back to the next person as well, to taking somebody under your wing. You don't have to show them your best spots, but show them the basic principles to help them set themselves up for success later on.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the U.S., as you well know, we're down to 5% of the population buying a hunting license. So, you know, we need to do everything that we can to help people get into the sport of hunting. And one of my main peeves is the internet and all these people that say, well, if you're not hunting my way, you're not hunting, you know. And in Mojo, if you're hunting, we have three things. If you're legal, moral, and ethical, and the last two are almost the same thing. If you're legal, moral, and ethical, we'll help you do it if we can. That's all we ask you to do. And if you like doing it this way, we just need hunters. We need to help people get into hunting because, you know, people migrating to the cities, I grew up in the country. I mean, country, you know, and I can walk out my back door and go hunting. Not that many people can do that today. And of course, I grew up in a hunting family, so my dad would take me hunting, you know. So we need to help people learn how to hunt.
You're exactly right. And I grew up out in the middle of nowhere. We had a post office and a little general store nearby that you could walk to. But other than that, you had to drive to whatever else you wanted in life. But we had four wheelers. We had ATV access to the mountains and stuff like that. But we grew up playing in the creek, getting dirty. And then I move and relocate and have a family of my own now. And my son's friends, they want to come to our house because we've got a backyard. We've got a creek behind our house. We've got 10 or 11 acres just outside of town. They can be kids, they can be boys, and they can enjoy the outdoors, whereas they live in town and they don't have those experiences. So it's a little different for today's society and the kids growing up, and it's sparking that future generation. And it's just, they don't have to be hard with it. You don't have to make it harsh. Make it enjoyable to ensure that you're passing this sport of hunting that we're all so passionate with to the next generation.
Yeah. And, you know, and the one thing that we need to think about is, they need to be successful. You know, if you say you go duck hunting five times and you ain't killed a duck, I ain't doing that no more, you know. So they need to get on a successful hunt somehow. And if you don't know what they're doing, that makes it harder to do. They can do it. I say, I did it. My dad took me hunting, but he didn't want to do anything. He raised bird dogs, want to shoot quail. Okay, that's great sport, but he didn't care anything about any other kind of hunting. So I learned about quail hunting with him, but I had to go learn the rest of it myself. But I grew up in the woods like you do. So, you know, you learn wood skills doing that.
Yeah, woodsmanship goes a long way. And that's one of the things that you do not figure out until you're out there. It takes time, and you have to put those pieces of the puzzle together a lot of times after that scenario plays out.
You know, we got a lot of things today that I didn't have when I was growing up, mostly the internet. But, you know, they got videos, podcasts like your podcast. They could go and learn a lot sitting in their house if they'll take the trouble to do so.
Oh, the amount of resources that we have with our cell phone. Mobile hunting applications allow me to scout, find public ground locations to be 25 years ago. Public ground, if you didn't go to the county or the state and get a map, you may not even know it existed in your area where you had access. Now I can palm of my hand, I can pull it up and be like, there's 100 acres close to my house that I can go hunt. I don't have to have permission from my neighbors anymore. I could just go walk on public, and I have that access to scout that and figure out and get a game plan together before I ever step foot on it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So if people want to hunt, it's available to them. they don't know, the young ones don't know that they want to hunt or not. That's the jump start we have to give them.
Yeah, for somebody that took somebody hunting for the first time, those natural instincts, whether they've ever hunted or not, whether they've ever been exposed to it, they're there for most kids, for most young adults. It's there. You just have to unlock it and relate that to a situation that they can enjoy.
It's still in our genes. Yeah. Still on our genes, but you got to have a opportunity, as you say, to use it some way, and that's what so many kids don't have today, opportunity.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with what you just said. Well, Terry, I have greatly appreciated you taking the time to be on the podcast today, allowing us the opportunity to learn more about Mojo, and for me, more about waterfowl hunting, something that I've had interest in the past, but never taking the time to do it. It's cold. It's expensive to get into sometimes, but I've got a buddy that's twisted my arm this season. He's like, you're going with us. So I wanted to reach out, make sure I got the chance to talk to you, learn more about this process and kind of light that fire. And maybe I'll start building my inventory of decoys and steel shot.
Well, the first time that the ducks really work like they're supposed to work, you'll be hooked after that, you know. So that's the day that when you're in the bed at night, you're still seeing those ducks landing in a decoy, and then you're hooked.
Well, that's what I'm hoping for. It's like I just need another hobby because I don't have enough already.
Really?
Sir, it's been a pleasure. Welcome back on the podcast anytime, and hopefully I see you here in Henrietta, Texas next spring.
I'm going to try to be there, so I'll hook you up.
Sounds great.
But we'll know ahead of time. They publish that. We'll know ahead of time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll know if we get a chance to get an invite. So hopefully we cross paths again in the near future, sir.
All right. Enjoy it. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.